Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Baghdad knows car bombs. So does Islamabad. But the May 1st car bomb attempt in Times Square was highly unusual for the United States. Now, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder says lines go right from that bombing to the Pakistan Taliban. The U.S. has organized to fight 9/11-style attacks. What about car bombs? This hour on Point, the new threat out of Pakistan. You can join the conversation. What's the answer here? Is this payback for drone attacks? The Taliban in New York? How do you stop a radicalized American? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. The story was kind of fading, but over the weekend, the Attorney General got very tough on this, talking about connections back to Pakistan. Here he is on the NBC's Meet the Press. He was asked if it's a danger that the Times Square bombing suspect, Faisal Shahzad, was initially being described as a lone wolf who acted alone.
Certainly looked, I think, at the beginning of this investigation, like it could have been a one-off. Over the course of this week, we've developed information, we've developed evidence that shows that the involvement of the Pakistani Taliban.
Involved, intimately involved, he went on to say. And here's Homeland Security Advisor John Brennan on CNN saying the Times Square bombing suspect, Faisal Shahzad, was likely working with Pakistan's Taliban.
As you know, Mr. Shahzad is in custody. He is being cooperative as far as responding to our questions. It looks like he was working on behalf of the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, the TTP. That's the Pakistan Taliban. This is a group that is closely allied with Al-Qaeda. They have been responsible for a number of attacks in Pakistan against Pakistani targets as well as U.S. targets. But this is something that we're taking very seriously. The investigation is ongoing, and we are learning more and more every day.
Looks like he says he was working on behalf of the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, the TTP, the Pakistan Taliban. We're learning a whole new vocabulary here. Joining me now from New York is Michael Sheehan, former deputy commissioner for counterterrorism in the New York Police Department. He was a member of the National Security Council under Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and a State Department senior advisor on counterterrorism. He's now president of Lexington Security Group, director of the Madison Policy Forum, and author of Crush the Cell, How to Defeat Terrorism Without Terrorizing Ourselves. Michael Sheehan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
And from Washington, Daniel Byman is with us, senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He's a former policy analyst and director for research at the Center for Middle East Public Policy at the RAND Corporation, served as a staff member on the 9/11 Commission, is author of The Five-Front War and Deadly Connections, States That Sponsor Terrorism. Dan Byman, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me back, Tom.
Dan Byman, first to you on the Attorney General and Mr. Brennan there over the weekend saying we have evidence that links this to the Pakistan Taliban. Does that come as a surprise?
That shouldn't come as a surprise. In recent months, we've seen many plots, many attacks linked back to Pakistan. And in general, there are relatively few lone wolves. At first, this is a common suspicion, but usually we see that individuals acted at least with some support from others at times around the world.
And Michael Sheehan, we're seeing this described as potentially payback over the weekend for the rain of drone attacks. President Obama has authorized more than 50 in his first year in office. That's more than President Bush did in his last 4 years in office. What about that idea of, you know, however bungled, a car bomb attempt in Times Square as payback ordered from Pakistan by people there who may have felt or been hit by drones?
Well, Dan is right. This isn't new. These guys have been thinking about projecting their activity outside the region for quite a while. Traditionally, in years back, the Taliban, both the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistan Taliban, were focused on an insurgency and regaining control of their areas and obviously recontrol of all of Afghanistan for the Afghanistan Taliban. But this is a bit of a new step for them, although it remains to be seen exactly which groups he's linked to. It's really a bit of a soup over there. These groups aren't they kind of overlap with one another.
But is this something new? I mean, after 9/11, we saw large-scale, epic-scale terrorism unleashed there, and we had the feeling that we were organizing, you know, to stop that. Is it a different kettle of fish when you get into individuals and car bombs, Michael?
Well, 9/11 was a unique attack. 19 people, 4 airplanes. Not a unique plot, because they had plotted something similar to that, Operation Bojink, in the mid-90s, and the Heathrow plot also just a few years back were large aviation plots. But in the interim, between, if you go all the way back to 1993 and Ramzi Youssef's car bomb attack against the World Trade Center, which is sort of a precursor to Al-Qaeda, as I refer to, all the way up to the Times Square plot, you see literally dozens and dozens of plots, unhatched plots, conducted here and in Europe with a full range of activities, from AK-47s to car bombs to backpack bombs against transit sites to even some of the more elaborate ones. So I'd be somewhat reluctant to say this is somewhat of a new trend. Fact of the matter is they've been at this for about 17 years now with all range of plots, whatever they can put together. They'll try to execute it. The bigger, the better. But in the interim, they'd like to pull off small ones to keep the momentum going.
Dan Byman, I want to ask you about that because, I mean, we saw the big one, but this possibility of a kind of a drip torture of smaller attacks is unsettling. Here's John Brennan again on CNN yesterday talking about the radical militant group, the Tariqi Taliban Pakistan, this TTP, and the possibility of them having trained Faisal Shahad, the suspect in the Times Square bombing.
The TTP has been training with, operating with, planning attacks with Al-Qaeda for a number of years. It is dedicated to the same type of agenda that Al-Qaeda has, which is a murderous one, to kill innocent civilians. They have operated inside of Pakistan. They have pledged to carry out attacks in other areas of the world, including in the United States here. So I think what this incident underscores is the serious threat that we face from a very determined enemy, and we have to remain very vigilant, and we have to do everything in our power to prevent them from carrying out successful attacks.
Dan Byman, I think the picture that people are beginning to get here from recent attacks, successful and failed, is of a Taliban closely allied with Al-Qaeda reaching out via the internet and sometimes directly to solicit Americans to join this effort. And here in the case of Faisal Shahad, that's what we've got. An American citizen of Pakistani descent goes back to Pakistan, returns, and tries, very unsuccessfully nevertheless, to put a car bomb in a pretty delicate spot.
This is what we've been concerned about for quite some time, which is individuals from the United States who might be angry and who go to Afghanistan, who go to Pakistan, and they're, instead of fighting locally, they're flipped and they go back to the United States or perhaps another Western country and attack there because of their passport, their language skills, their knowledge of the culture. That makes them far more formidable. But in the bigger scheme of things, this is almost a return to the familiar in terms of the type of attack. Car bombs certainly are nothing new. And this is the sort of attack you see when a group has real but nevertheless limited resources and when many of its operatives are unskilled. As Michael Sheehan said, 9/11 was really the unusual attack. This is sort of the more typical thing that we're likely to deal with for years, if not decades, to come.
Michael Sheehan, now the Attorney General is talking about suspending Miranda rights for terror suspects so that they can be questioned before they get an attorney. That sounds like an administration calling for a pretty significant change in policy to address the possibility of a whole lot more single players.
Well, I think it's actually just a little bit of a shift. Even after the Christmas attempt of the so-called underpants bomber, they delayed reading the Miranda rights for 9 hours. But I think the administration needs to be very careful about this. This issue has been so politicized due to the incidences of the past administration with Abu Ghraib and with Gitmo and torture, and somehow we've sort of got to clear away all that political baggage and think about what's the best way to get information from these people that protect public safety and yet not trample on somebody's civil liberties. The fact of the matter is Miranda is something used for criminals in order that they don't in order to protect what type of evidence is brought into trial. The fact of the matter is normally if you arrest a guy, you've already got a case against them. In this case of Times Square, they have a tremendous case. So much more interested in getting information this guy to prevent another attack if this guy was connected to other cells than worrying about getting information from him that might be excluded from a civil trial in the U.S. So I think the administration is really trying to sweep away the politics of Miranda and torture and the CIA and Gitmo and figure out what's the best way, what's the best thing to do for public safety, and not worry about the political issues of Miranda, which has so much more of a symbol than really what's really happening with the interviews by police and FBI guys on the ground.
But, of course, it's also a constitutional issue, as described by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1966, not just
it's
a
only a constitutional issue, and that information gotten before Miranda can't be used in the trial. And law enforcement officials may make a judgment and say, we're more interested in getting information from this guy than worried about access to a trial. It's not as if you don't give a guy Miranda rights, it gives a license to torture people. I think it's really more about what's the best way to move forward when you have a guy in custody in terms of the trade-off between immediate issue of public safety for a potential terrorist organization versus worrying about the legal technicalities of information taken from the interviews and what's going to be allowed into the trial later on down. And that's what we have to do, is separate the emotional issues from what's really best interest of public safety. And it really is not an issue of whether, if you don't read a guy's Miranda rights in the first 5 minutes, it kind of allows you to torture and abuse the guy. That's not the case at all. It has to do with admissibility of information picked up later on down the road.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Islamic militants in Pakistan and terrorism, the car bomb scenario in the USA. Michael Sheehan's with us, former deputy commissioner for the counterterrorism with the NYPD. Dan Byman is here. He's a senior fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution. And we're joined right now from Islamabad in Pakistan by Musharraf Zaidi, columnist for Pakistan's biggest English language newspaper, The News, and for the Egyptian paper, Al-Sharuk. His work also appears in the Far Eastern Economic Review. Musharraf Zaidi, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
What's going on with the Taliban in Pakistan that may be producing the kind of thing we saw in Times Square on May 1st? Is there some change afoot?
Well, I think, you know, it's a mixture of good and bad news. So the good news, of course, is that over the past 6 years, since June 2004, when the drone program began, and then upwards since 2006, when the Pakistani military started to take substantially more aggressive action against terrorists and militant positions, what we've been seeing is a gradual, consistent degeneration of the capabilities of Al-Qaeda and its affiliate organizations here, including this umbrella coalition that's called the TTP, the Tehreek-e Taliban Pakistan. So that's the good news. The good news is these guys operationally aren't as their organograms don't have any people in them. There's a bunch of holes, and so they don't operate the way that they used to. Unfortunately, the bad news is that leaves a lot of space for walk-on terrorists that are otherwise lone wolves, but that are basically looking to do something crazy and that find that crazy in the mess that's been left in the aftermath of the destruction of parts of the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. So you have potentially many more Faisal Shahzads walking around. And so what I've stated before is, I mean, we were really lucky that this guy was possibly the world's stupidest terrorist, up there with the fellow from Detroit on the Christmas Day bombing plot. What we should be really scared of, possibly, is that the next guy, the next Faisal Shahzad, or Abu Mutalib, is not going to be that dumb, and that he will be much, much smarter.
Might put together a more effective explosive. Musharraf, what about this equation that was posed over the weekend in the New York Times, that the car bomb attempt in Times Square and other lone actors that we've seen recently may be an attempt by the Pakistan Taliban as payback for those drone attacks, where some quite high leaders have been hit? What about that idea?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility, certainly. And I think it's interesting how you described it, because, I mean, the more generic way to describe it certainly in Pakistan, where I'm located, is that generally it's not just the Taliban who are upset about the drone attacks. There's a lot of pride and dignity issues that are sort of wrapped up in all of this. And a lot of Pakistanis, whether they're in the tribal areas themselves or outside, they're not quite comfortable with the idea of these drones dropping missiles. Now, we don't actually know exactly how many civilian casualties these drones are producing, but we do know they are producing some. And so the question isn't just whether this is the Taliban themselves offering payback for the legitimate sort of destruction of the Taliban at the hands of the drones, but is there also a question perhaps of non-terrorists, you know, people like Faisal Shahzad who don't have any sort of background, who become radicalized as a function of watching civilian death, or at least becoming wrapped up in the narrative of civilian deaths.
Mushraf Zaidi, please stand by in Islamabad. Dan Byman, what about this notion of it, things somehow becoming more personalized? I mean, 9/11 was meant to make an enormous statement. We've all grown familiar with, for example, in Baghdad, car bombs being, you know, sort of day by day or week by week, tit for tat, blow for blow kind of strikes. Is there a risk of that becoming the dynamic here between New York City or the United States and very distant Pakistan, that we're into that kind of you hit me, I hit you routine?
Not to the degree we see in a country like Iraq, but that back and forth is part of a sustained struggle against terrorist organizations. We've seen this in other countries as well, where what begins often with a strategic logic from the terrorist group at times becomes a personal one, where they've lost a comrade, they've lost a father, they've lost a leader, and what they want is blood in return. And that's not terribly surprising. It's a very human dimension. And what's interesting in Pakistan is al-Qaeda and bin Laden have deliberately tried to play on this, where they've tried to work with groups that had a focus primarily on Pakistan or on the broader region, and they've tried to expand their agenda to include, you know, the West, the United States. And they've done this in part not just by trying to convince them ideologically, but by playing on personal motives.
Michael Sheehan, we've got comments here on online and on Facebook, and we've got a Steve saying, look, you know, a lot more people die on our highways than as a result of car bombs, and this sounds like a media scare. He's sick of it. On the other hand, we've got Larry on Facebook saying car bombs are an efficient terror delivery system. It's only a matter of time before a competent terrorist actually delivers one. So far, it seems like inept terrorists have been our first line of defense. But could you see a rain of individual kind of pinpricks compared to 9/11? But nevertheless, they get everybody's attention.
And by the way, I think both those comments are right. On the one hand, more people die every year from bee stings, let alone car wrecks in the United States and terrorist attacks. The numbers are very, very small. But nevertheless, the other guy is right, too. If they're able to sustain a lot of these attacks, it could have the effect of creating a great deal of fear with a widespread impact on the U.S. and our economy. But I think it's important to recognize that as long as we don't overreact, and we can keep these things very well spaced out, that actually it has no strategic value at all against a country as large and as dynamic as the United States. So there's a balance here between retaining our focus to continue to debilitate terrorist organizations that try to attack us, yet taking a page out of the book of both the Israelis and the British that seem to get over these attacks very quickly and don't let it disrupt their daily lives.
But certainly they can have big political effects, and that does flow towards strategy. Let's go to our phones. Tom in Waterbury, Connecticut. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello to your guests. My question is this. How does a country as the United States, with the best technology and the best resources, fail to prevent this effect from coming to our home?
Michael, let me put it to you. You're with the NYPD. How can such a big country with all of our technology and prowess fail to protect against?
Well, the fact of the matter is we have protected it since 9/11, which is almost 9 years now. Al-Qaeda and its family of organizations and part of this movement have failed in conducting a successful attack in almost 9 years. That's an extraordinary record of achievement of our government agencies that are working very hard both here in the United States and abroad to prevent al-Qaeda from getting skilled and trained operatives together to conduct a successful attack, and they're trying hard. It's been about 30 plots unraveled in the United States in the past 9 years, so we've done pretty well. And what was mentioned before, one of our best allies has been the incompetence of al-Qaeda operatives trying to attack us, but part of the reason they're incompetent is because we continue to hammer at the central organization, which prevents them from recruiting the A-team like they did on 9/11, prevents them from having the types of training bases and secure areas to recruit, train, and launch really effective operators. So, in effect, we've done pretty well, and we've also had a degree of luck.
Musharraf Saidi in Islamabad, how has the news of Faisal Shahzad's American citizenship and his attempt in Times Square been received in Pakistan? What are people saying about it? Are they thinking, we may see more of this, or this sounds like something rare and strange?
Well, there's many different kinds of reactions. I think the fact that he's an American, even though he's a relatively new American, a lot of Pakistanis want to use that to, in a sense, undermine the Pakistani part of his identity. Obviously, Pakistanis both at home in Pakistan and the sort of very large Pakistani-American community stateside are concerned about being labeled and being profiled on the basis of this fellow. But, you know, I think there's also definitely a sense being besieged in Pakistan at the government level and in terms of police officials and people who are involved in the front line of our own war on terror. There's a real sense that, you know, increased pressure, the kind of pressure that Hillary Clinton applied day before yesterday when she talked about severe consequences, that kind of pressure is actually going to be very difficult for Pakistanis to absorb other problems that Pakistan is facing. And so there's a real fear that this thing is going to create sustained pressure on Pakistan to do things that it may be incapable of doing.
Dan Byman, there's talk about there's heavy pressure on Pakistan to go more aggressively after Al-Qaeda and Taliban within its borders. Also talk about more and more U.S. troops being in there, special forces and otherwise. Do you think the pressure so far here is having the effect of squelching Al-Qaeda and the Pakistan Taliban or making it more determined to hit the U.S., Dan?
Well, I don't think it's really possible to make Al-Qaeda more determined to hit the United States. It's had that goal for quite some time now, and as we've learned quite painfully, it's often able to do so. But to go back to the earlier points other speakers have raised, we've hit the center of Al-Qaeda hard through drone strikes, through arrests around the world, and that's kept it off balance. It's kept its head down. Now, by having some degree of a haven in Pakistan, especially in recent years, it's been able to regrow and redevelop. And we've seen individuals go there for training. We've seen some degree of command and control coming out of Pakistan, and that's made the organization more capable. So the real key is to keep the pressure on. And the ideal people to do that are the Pakistani government, are the Pakistani army and Pakistani intelligence. Where they're unable, at times where they're unwilling, that's where the drone program, that's where other U.S. efforts have to come in.
Musharraf Zaidi in Islamabad, do you agree that keeping the pressure on is the answer here? More drone strikes, more pressure in general?
Well, look, I think there's obviously political considerations here as well. I don't think that that this Times Square plot can go off without the Obama administration demonstrating some sort of backbone and some sort of vigor in its response with respect to Pakistan. So I do think that there will be an increase in those kinds of things, but I don't think that's the answer. In the larger sort of continuum of what is happening in this country, we are seeing that since 2006, when operations by the Pakistani military, as well as the drones, were scaled up, there's been more and more terrorist attacks in Pakistan. And so there's also sort of a dual sort of a thing going on, and that is that the Pakistani people themselves, are not just besieged in terms of U.S. pressure to do more, but are besieged by terrorism within Pakistan. And so I think that because a lot of Pakistanis have begun to think that this terrorism is a direct result of America's pressure on Pakistan, increased pressure on Pakistan might not go down as well as we'd like it to.
What an interesting picture. Let's get a call from Brookline, Massachusetts, and Rarit. Rarit, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. What I wanted to say is that I feel like Americans have to change the way they think and the way of life. I know they will not like it, but in Israel, to avoid a scare of a bomb in a restaurant or in a supermarket or in a drugstore, we have a guard on every store, and whenever you have to go in, even to a bar, somebody is checking your bag. And it has to be the same here. I had guests from Israel, and somebody, I took them to the mall, and somebody left a bag on a bench, and the child was 10 years old, she became hysterical. She thought it was a bomb, and nobody around pay attention. People were very, you know, because it used to be a very free country. You could do what you want, and it felt very good when I came over, because there was not the nervousness all the time. But I think you're coming to a new phase, and I think it's all over the world, not only in America.
Jarit, I hope not, but maybe you're right. Michael Sheehan, what about it? Do we need to change our way of life and be checking at the entrance to every restaurant and bar and store?
No, I absolutely think not. We do not have to do that, and I think if we remain focused and continue what we've done, and by the way, I'm not including the Iraq War or really even the long-term occupation of Afghanistan in this counterterrorism equation I'm talking about. But if we continue to do what we've done in terms of beating back Al-Qaeda, central organization, and their cells around the world, we don't have to become a nation under siege. That would empower the terrorists. That would amplify their capability, which in the United States is very rudimentary at best. So I don't think we're at that point now, and hopefully we won't in the future.
But what about the see something, say something idea that had vendors speaking up about the SUV in Times Square, but also had people in New York over the weekend, you know, hot and bothered about an abandoned cooler?
You know, I think we underestimate New Yorkers and their resiliency. I think they get it. I think that if they see something suspicious, they're going to report it to the police, and then they're going to go about their business. You know, after the attempted plot was a Saturday night, on Sunday morning, there were thousands of bicyclers riding through right through Times Square on a pre-planned event the next day, thousands of them driving up and down 6th Avenue. And right after that false alarm in Times Square the other day, I was down there doing an NBC News hit, thousands of tourists and local New Yorkers right back in Times Square, right back to it. So I think Americans get this. They understand there are risks in the world, but they're not going to turn themselves upside down over these organizations, and nor should they.
Dan, you heard our caller's warning that the U.S. is going to have to change. What do you anticipate?
Fortunately, I don't think the threat situation in the United States is remotely near what Israel faced, especially during the height of Second Intifada in Israel. As Michael Sheehan has pointed out, there have been a number of plots, but not successful. And we don't have the same danger of daily attacks throughout this country. The real key is in some key areas, New York being one of them, a degree of vigilance by the citizens and by local police. And that can pay off, as we saw in Times Square. And that's tremendously valuable. But there's a difference between living in fear and living with fear. And the real key is to make sure that we can go on our daily lives, even though people recognize that it's a dangerous world out there.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Islamic militants in Pakistan and terrorism, the car bomb scenario in the United States. May 1st, we saw the attempt in Times Square. It was not very effective. Nevertheless, it got a lot of people's attention, and there's a lot of attention being paid right now to what's brewing in Pakistan. Musharraf Zaidi joins us there. He's a columnist for The News, joins us from Islamabad in Pakistan. Dan Byman is here from the Brookings Institution, author of The Five-Front War and Deadly Connections, joins us from Washington. And Michael Sheehan is here, author of Crush the Cell, How to Defeat Terrorism Without Terrorizing Ourselves. He was deputy commissioner for counterterrorism with the NYPD. Let's go to Tori in Marlborough, Massachusetts. Tori, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm wondering if anybody has thought that this Pakistani-born U.S. citizen is not like a double spook, and that he was not an abominable incompetent at the Times Square on May 1, but that, in fact, he wanted to be caught. He wanted to tell us what he had learned so that he could share some information that we may not have.
Why not just walk into a police station if he wanted to do that, Tori?
No, because he also needs to be able to go back again. He tried and failed. Okay, he bumbled it in the Pakistani's eyes. He tried and failed, and he looks that way to us. But in fact, we certainly are getting a lot of information from him, aren't we?
Well, they say that he's talking a lot, but I have a feeling he's not going to be going anywhere for a long time. Michael Sheen, first of all, just for factually, in terms of what's likely to happen with Faisal Shahzad, there are charges. Presumably, he'll spend a long time in jail.
Oh, yeah, he's facing capital charges for attempted murder and attempted terrorism and using a weapon of mass destruction. They have a lot of charges stacking up against him. You know, sometimes we don't understand how the world can be such, and so we look deeper into it, because here's a guy with a great education that's such a bungled bomb, you wonder what happened. But I think the case here is what it is. This is a guy who self-radicalized, went to Pakistan, became further radicalized, got some training, and then came back and really botched his bomb attack. Perhaps he got a little bit more training, was a little bit more disciplined. But I don't think there's anything more than meets the eye in this case. It's pretty straightforward.
Dan Byman, what do you see going on in the fringe element of the American Muslim community that is drawn to this siren song of terrorism now? What's happening here? I mean, this is not just one. We're seeing there were arrests around the clusters that have gone back to Pakistan have been intercepted. Of course, we saw the terrible slaughter inside the U.S. military not so long ago at a U.S. Army base, military base. And now we've got Shahzad, and we had the arrests of the guy who was working down a Wall Street back around the turn of the year. What's going on here, Dan?
We should begin by pointing out that we're still dealing with a fraction of a fraction of a community that has cooperated very closely at times with American counterterrorism officials at the state, local, and federal levels. But we are seeing some individuals, whether self-radicalizing or in particular, going back and forth to Pakistan or having connections to Pakistan. And that is the great concern, which is that they go from being individuals who are untrained, uncoordinated, in general unable to act despite whatever feelings they might have, to individuals who are much more skilled and much more dangerous. And that's, again, why this connection to Pakistan is of such great concern, because it's the brain. It's the way that individuals join a group, and a group becomes far more formidable. And we are seeing that shift, and the reasons are unclear. But nevertheless, we do see a greater concentration than we've seen in past years.
What's the net that may catch someone who's, you know, discontented, maybe even open to joining in militancy? How does that happen? Is it all on the web? You get off the airplane in Islamabad or Karachi? You know, how does it happen, Dan? Do we know?
We don't have a good sense. Social scientists have looked at this extensively, and they can point to dissatisfaction on a variety of things, whether usually social or political. But there are lots of dissatisfied people, and only a few take this drastic step. What often happens, though, is individuals are upset by one local conflict. So, for example, some Somali Americans living in Minneapolis were upset by the Ethiopian invasion of Somalia. But then when they go to Somalia to join the fight, there the risk is they become exposed to a broader ideology that pushes them not just locally but also back against the United States or globally against what al-Qaeda wants, which is to try to strike enemies around the world.
Michael Sheehan, how do you deal with this strictly on a policing basis? I think I've read there's something like 200,000 flyers per year between Pakistan and the United States, maybe more. That's a lot of traffic if you have to be concerned about lone actors here.
It is difficult. Let me echo what Dan said. The real challenge is when they do go over there and get linked up with serious organizations, come back much more lethal. By the way, that's where Mohammed Atta was originally recruiting. He wanted to go fight over there and was turned back by bin Laden back to the U.S. Mohammed Siddiqui Khan, the British bomber who blew up the subway there, also went there to fight locally and was turned around. This is the model. What we have to do is there's three parts of finding these guys. Number one, keep very vigilant locally with networks and intelligence and investigations to find if these guys connect to cells locally. Secondly, you need intelligence operations in the theater in Pakistan with the Pakistani authorities, with the U.S. trying to find where they're connecting to. And then the third part of it is the travel, and that's really important. And I think what we're going to need is a much higher degree of profiling of people in the airways that narrow down the population of the people that we're looking for, and that can be done. That coupled with intelligence, and hopefully we can cut off that third aspect of it. But it's a broader intelligence effort, domestically, internationally, and in the travel.
Musharraf Saidi, in Islamabad, there's been a lot of pressure from Washington and renewed since this attempted car bomb in Times Square. Do you see Pakistan responding, stepping up their policing and even their military action, or are they politically unwilling to do that?
Well, there's both an inability and an unwillingness. And the unwillingness comes from a really deep desire to prevent this thing from getting further out of hand. About a year ago, when I was last on the show, Tom, we were talking about the Taliban being 60 miles from Islamabad, and that's when the military operation took a completely new dimension. I think that really woke up a lot of Pakistanis within the sort of political and military elite about the need to really take this on and push it back. But I also think there's a fear that if they open every front that's available, and of course the next big front that the Obama administration is pushing Pakistan on is North Waziristan.
Yes.
I think a lot of pressure from the U.S. pushing Pakistan to act in North Waziristan may or may not sort of yield results in terms of what the Pakistani military does, but I think a lot of Pakistanis, myself included, I think we're concerned that if the government does take on militants and terrorists in North Waziristan, will we see another repeat of the last year and a half of a sort of wave of bloodshed across our cities as we were trying to get to South Waziristan? So I think there's that fear that is going to arrest the willingness of the Pakistani state to act more firmly.
Let's go to Bill in Exeter, New Hampshire. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. The best way to insult an author is to ignore their works. Why should we embolden them, give them so much credit, and invite them to come over here by giving them that much attention and that much media and press? We should just ignore them.
Well, Michael, how about it? I mean, this was a bungled attempt in Times Square, but what if it had gone off with the propane tanks and the gasoline and whatever else was in the Nissan Pathfinder there? What might the impact have been, Michael?
Well, this bomb, even under the best of circumstances, would have just been a fireball that could have killed or injured a few people right near it. Had it been packed with other explosives and perhaps the fertilizer they put in there that wasn't properly put together either, you could have big bombs like Timothy McVeigh, a 5,000-pound truck bomb, which basically obliterated the government building in Oklahoma City. You can have some very serious bombs. But I agree with the point. We have to be careful about over-aggrandizing these terrorist people who are looking to make a statement, whether personally, politically, or religiously. And that's finding that balance between keeping focused on our counterterrorism efforts without amplifying these guys and making them something they're not. So the caller makes a good point.
But Dan Byman, I mean, aggrandize or not, now we have the U.S. Attorney General talking about making pretty broad new exceptions to Miranda rights. I mean, that's a big step.
I think it's impossible to kind of sweep this under the rug, nor should we. I take the caller's point that you don't want to create too much attention, but you can use this as a way to kind of dry run the system. You see what works. You think about how quickly we got the guy, mistakes we made along the process, and you try to fix it because it's a way of getting the system to take it seriously, and it's a way of getting Americans to recognize that this problem is still there, even if it's not on the front pages on a daily basis like it was 8-9 years ago. So there is some value to focusing on it. And of course, we're going to see political figures focus on it as well for their own purposes, whether to emphasize their agencies or to show that their preferred policy is the best one, whatever that is.
Let's go to Brody in Greenville, Kentucky. Brody, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hey. I'm just wondering what your guests think. The attacks or the attempted attacks here in our states, how can we not expect those to grow as a result from blowback of our occupation of Iraq and of these constant 24-hour, you know, you're reading about these drone planes that are making runs 24 hours a day, and we're going to be increasing those in the future. How can we not expect some kind of blowback from this, what I would consider, if I was a citizen in that country, a terrorist attack from above? I know that we are targeting terrorists, but it might look, to me, it looks differently if you live in that country. So you're in constant fear of these drone attacks. And I would just think that blowback would be something we need to consider here.
Dan Byman, what do you say? There was talk not long ago that Al-Qaeda was on the run and this idea of wrapping it up. But it does certainly maybe on the run, but it certainly hasn't gone away. And you've got more people here putting their hands up to say, me too. What about the blowback problem?
Blowback is a very real problem, and things like the drone attacks, especially when you expand it from a narrow al-Qaeda base to some broader groups in Pakistan, do have that risk. What we're seeing is really a tension between going after broader intentions versus going after capabilities. When you attack these groups and individuals, you may make them angrier, you may widen the circle of people who want to harm you. But at the same time, if you do it right, you make them less capable of doing so. And that's what we seem to have seen in Pakistan in recent years, is severe blows to the organization's capability. You still have the hatred, you still have the anger, you still have the intent, but you don't have the ability to the same degree you had certainly 10 years ago.
Let's go to Bob in Montpelier, Vermont. Bob, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Back a little while ago, one of your speakers referred to Miranda rights as a legal technicality, and I just feel like I got to point out what that is a constitutional right, that it's not some technicality, that there is always some reason to trample on civil. In my lifetime, one of the things that I witnessed was that communists were such a terrible threat to this country that we couldn't afford civil liberties, you know, that we had to root out. A little before I was born, people with Japanese grandparents were such a terrible threat. They had to be rounded up and put in concentration camps. You know, I watched the Twin Towers burn, and what I said was, some guy in Washington right now is writing a plan to trample civil liberties. And that guy wasn't writing a plan. He was pulling a plan out of a desk.
Ready to go. Ready to dial them back. But what if? I mean, it's been pretty light footfall so far. But we had a car bomb attempt here, Bob, that if it had been, you know, the real deal, could have killed a lot of people in Times Square.
Sure it could have. And do you think that getting rid of civil liberties is going to get rid of a guy like that? I mean, that one of the things that we unfortunately are going to have to learn to deal with, like the Israelis and like the Iraqis, is the fact that there are some wackos who, if they're motivated enough, can kill people. But to trample, to get rid of civil liberties for the rest of us, it's misguided at best, and it's evil at worst.
Bob, we've got it, Michael Sheehan, you hear, and you know that this is a very widely held view among Americans. We're trained to value our civil liberties, and even when you've got this kind of attempt, people don't want to see them go away. Bob doesn't see Miranda rights as a technicality.
Well, I didn't say that either, but it's a question of when you do Miranda rights, and we're not talking about trampling on somebody's civil liberties. We're talking about getting information from somebody in a completely legal manner about a possible second attack or simultaneous attack, or to roll up the cell that may be plotting another one the next day with thousands of lives that could be at stake. The question is, and I understand the concerns about civil liberties, and we should very, very much cherish them. But what would be even worse is that if we're short-sighted and didn't do the right thing to prevent terrorism, we'll have a lot of these types of attacks, and then the pressure to even have more draconian steps that would be even more dangerous to our civil liberties would even be more dramatic. So what I'm saying is just have common sense. And which means that you don't have to rush and read a guy's Miranda rights as soon as he steps off of an airplane if he's a terrorist. We're talking about conducting very lawful interviews and interrogations over people, but getting information for public safety, and I'm talking about a very common sense approach. There'll be plenty of time to read the guy's Miranda rights and make sure that the judicial procedures go according to our Constitution. But so we have to. What I'm asking for is we don't allow the emotion of the abuses, perhaps, of that people feel were conducted by the Bush administration, that we have to rush into the pendulum swinging back a little bit too far, and that we don't take common sense approaches to protect ourselves.
Well, there doesn't seem to be much risk of that right now with the Obama administration saying it's going to go after law, allowing investigators to interrogate terrorism suspects without informing them of their rights. People watching very closely here, our caller Bob included. Musharraf Zaidi in Pakistan, what do you see? You say you've got the Al-Qaeda under pressure, but do you see it receding? Do you see it being wrapped up? Or are we looking at years more of this?
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of the answer to that depends on the presence of the U.S. in Afghanistan, and my anticipation is that in terms of a very large footprint, that presence is going to be substantially reduced over the next 24 to 36 months, which means that in terms of the United States, there's a generic threat, there is a narrative of a civilizational conflict. I don't believe that it's real. There are a lot of people that believe it, both within the sort of American sort of far right, as well as, you know, across the Muslim world, and it's far right, further than far right, the terrorism that that plagues so many of our countries. But I think that the fight that Pakistan has to fight is a long-term one, and it is an intergenerational one, because the challenges we have here are substantially different from the ones you guys have there. For one, you're having a debate about Miranda rights. We don't have that debate. Many of the people that are suspected of having terrorist linkages disappear in this country.
But the challenges certainly intersect. Musharraf Zaidi with the news in Islamabad, thank you very much for being with us. Dan Byman and Michael Sheehan, thanks to each of you for your time today. Very grateful. And listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.